Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide, here in Tandanya, on the lands of Kanamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show,
some organisations that have a view, the type of work they do, the type of organisation they have, the culture that they want to have is best delivered by being in the office more. And I think there are other organisations who think the current hybrid working patterns are working just fine.
A new battle has emerged around the balance between workers' well-being and business needs, as more employers push for a return to the office. And later, a number of experts point to a growing trend in pseudo-law and the sovereign citizen movement, with the alleged shooter of two police officers in rural Victoria reportedly linked with the trend. And later,
because of the extreme rain that we've been seeing, the fields are waterlogged, they're not safe to play on, they get closed by council, which means that kids and adults alike are missing out on actually getting out there and playing the games that they love.
A number of Aussie athletes are calling on the federal government to pledge $100 million to protect community sports hubs from the rising impacts of climate change. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, it's been almost 6 months and still South Australia's toxic algae continues to devastate coastlines, recording one of the worst bloom explosions on record, impacting over 400 species and spanning 4,500 square kilometres. The state's York Peninsula is reeling from the effects, with locals calling the federal government to trigger climate emergency funding to protect threatened species. In response, members of the Marion Bay community and Sydney artist Patrick Hunter, who donated design, paints and time, have revealed a large-scale mural urging the situation to be declared a national crisis. The artwork depicts the rare leafy sea dragon and giant Australian cuttlefish, species experts fear could be majorly under threat. I spoke with lead artist Patrick, aka Ink Hunter, local artist Jasmine Swales, and local Lockie Cameron.
Patrick, I go by Ink Hunter. I'm a mural artist. I focus on environmental themes and community engagement.
My name's Lockie Cameron. I live on Southern York Peninsula and have witnessed the impacts of the bloom firsthand since April. Early April.
My name's Jasmine Swales. I am a community arts facilitator on Southern York Peninsula and run a small art gallery with my artist husband, Jason Swales, as well.
Wonderful. Thanks so much and thanks all for joining. I'm here in Adelaide and Marion Bay is 3 hours or just under 300 kilometres away, part of the York Peninsula, which has been hugely impacted by the algal bloom. So from a local perspective, what's the general feeling in the community?
We've seen the devastation on the beaches with a lot of deaths and the concern over what's happening out there, what's caused it. The community has really suffered with the loss of tourism as well as part of it, but just that long-term concern over what's happening with our environment, I think that's the key concern.
And Lockie, do you have anything to add to that? What's the general feeling within the community?
I think there's just massive amounts of concern. It's so widespread now. I don't know, when it first hit Marion Bay and those Southern York areas, it seemed like there wasn't much of a response, and it did take until it kind of impacted those metro beaches for a response to occur. The mortalities have sort of stopped around Marion Bay and Fowle Bay at the moment, but that damage has been done. And so just because stuff isn't still washing up doesn't mean that the problem's just gone.
You know, the problem is so significant. Over 13,000 marine animals from almost 400 species have been affected. And I understand the York Peninsula community is demanding the federal government to trigger emergency funding to protect threatened species. You have revealed the mural Southern Bloom. Despite the situation being extremely dark, the mural is very, very bright. Can you please describe the mural and the intent or calls behind it?
Yeah, the intent of the mural was to provoke thought and change, and some of the design in it is a crossover between ripples, and you can make positive or negative ripples in our environment and how we touch nature, and then kind of also represents that finger mark and the natural thing of how everyone has come together and the community of how the whole project was mostly due a crossover point. So it was from protecting the Great Southern Reef from the oil and gas rigs that were going to get put down, and that seeing the beautiful underwater photography from the Great Southern Reef project was something that I started following from that project. And then seeing the devastation led to me reaching out and wanting to go to Marion Bay. And then I kind of rocked up, probably a little bit unprepared, but had all my paint and everything ready to go.
Jasmine, can you please talk a little bit about how you and Jason were involved and how you've used the devastating impact of the algae bloom and translated that into the artwork?
I guess as community members that also have those similar values and concerns on our environment, we've worked with Lockie Cameron for years on other projects like what Pat had mentioned with the oil rigs in the Bight and just protecting our oceans from things like that. And then with the algal bloom just coming out of nowhere and just causing such devastation. Like the day that Pat rocked up, we didn't know actually that he was coming. Like it was just a act on what's happening, I guess. And it came out of nowhere, and then Pat came out of nowhere. And you've got to act fast when these kind of things are happening. So the community was really supportive of Pat coming. We pretty much had a day to get the consultation process happening and the community on board and working with our community members and Progress Association.
And Lockie, I understand that you've been involved with citizen science, with mapping the impacts of the algae bloom. Can you share a little bit about what that has been like for you and why a community or citizen involvement has been so important?
Heartbreaking. There were days that we walked the beaches and it was death every single step. It was like watching the entire ecosystem wash onto the beach with no explanation. It was just, happening right in front of our eyes at the beaches where I learned to swim and learned to snorkel. And then it just continued to spread throughout the peninsula and Kangaroo Island. Heartbreaking. I feel like I watched the whole bay's worth of weedy sea dragons wash in on one day. Thousands of sharks and rays and other species coming in. On the importance of it, it's the iNaturalist project that was created. For one, it's allowed people to be involved and feel like they are doing something positive in amongst such a large issue. And it's also provided an invaluable piece of evidence that shows just how widespread and how large the impact of the bloom actually is. That 13,000 affected, I think that that number is actually 100 times higher. I'm not quite sure where it's come from, but I personally have seen more than 13,000 things dead on the beach. It's heartbreaking because it rips your heart out.
In terms of now shifting with this mural taking place, what's been your response to it and also response from the community around this mural, taking something so desperately heartbreaking and channeling that to art and making calls to our government?
I think it's beautiful. I think Pat Incunt has done such an amazing job, and all credit needs to go to Jazz and Jace Swales for all of the work they did helping Pat get sorted on it. Also, Stefan at Great Southern Reef originally reached out to me. Like Jazz said, there was a bit of miscommunication, but what they managed to pull off down in Marion Bay is just fantastic, and I hope there's more of it around the state as we move forward.
Local Lockie Cameron, lead artist Patrick Hunter, aka Ink Hunter, and local artist Jasmine Swales.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
As more employers push for a return to the office, questions around mental health, flexibility, and workplace rights are coming to the surface. Unions are calling for stronger protections, researchers are warning of the psychological toll, and HR professionals are caught in the middle, trying to balance well-being with business needs. The Wire's Thomas Kutis reports.
Are you someone that works from home, but your bosses want you to be back in the office more often? Well, if this is you, you're not alone. It's 8:45 in the morning. One worker logs in from their kitchen bench and another squeezes onto a packed train headed for the CBD. 5 years after the pandemic rewrote the rules of work, Australia is still negotiating the balance between boardrooms and bedrooms. So this poses the question, is the push to return to the office about productivity or control?
Some organisations that have a view that the type of work they do, the type of organisation they have, the culture that they want to have is best delivered by being in the office more. And I think there are other organisations who think that the current hybrid working patterns are working just fine for them. And when you think about the 70% of employers who think that hybrid working is going to remain the same, I think the organisations that are saying they'd like everybody in the office full-time are very much the outliers.
Beyond productivity and policy, there's a deeper layer to this debate, and that is mental well-being. Dr. Libby Sander is an assistant professor of organisational behaviour at the Bond University Business School. She has spent years studying how our physical work environments shape our emotional and cognitive health. Her research shows that open plan offices can increase stress and worsen moods.
So what we see in terms of when people do work from home in the research, they're able to control visual distractions, auditory distractions far more easily than they are in the office. And we know that those two things are one of the biggest causes of stress, frustration, reduced performance, increase in negative mood when people are in the office. They're often interrupted either by overhearing other people on the phone, on Teams calls, or by simply walking by, having conversations next to their desk. And that's very difficult for people to concentrate and get work done.
Many employers are tightening return-to-office mandates, citing collaboration, culture and productivity. About 39% of Australian businesses now expect full-time office attendance, even though remote work proved viable for years. The Australian Services Union is pushing back. They've proposed a presumed right to work from home, arguing that flexibility isn't a perk, it's a necessity. Scott Cowan is the Assistant National Secretary of the Australian Services Union.
Well, I think working from home is pretty clear. It's a permanent feature of a modern Australian workplace now. Certainly not a luxury, and it's something that all employers have adapted and dealt with. I don't think any reasonable person would consider it a luxury where you can reasonably work from home, not to have that permitted from time to time.
Scott Cowan also highlights the concerns he has heard from his members regarding digital access, work-life boundaries, or job security while working remotely.
There's been a lot of discussion about this in terms of, where work creeps into your personal life. What's wonderful news is that just this week, workers in all Australian workplaces now, under the Fair Work Act, now have the protections of the right to disconnect. So that's small businesses and large businesses. I think that will, really go a long way in making sure that employers' attempts to contact employees outside of work will be protected.
So how are workplaces responding to this? I spoke to Sarah McCann-Barlett, who is the CEO of the Australian HR Institute. She and her team conducted a survey early in the year which found that hybrid work levels will continue to stabilise in the coming years.
At the beginning of this year, we ran our third survey on hybrid and flexible working in Australia. And what we found was that the first thing is that hybrid work patterns have generally stabilised across Australia. So there's been very little change from 2 years ago to this year. And the second thing is that 70% of employers have told us that they think hybrid working patterns are going to remain the same over the next 2 years. So they think hybrid work is here to stay.
Sarah McCann-Bartlett, the CEO of the Australian HR Institute, ending that report by The Wire's Thomas Kutis. $14 million Australians use community sports facilities, but 66% of Aussie community sports clubs are struggling to make ends meet. founder of Cricket for Climate, and Australian Test cricket captain Pat Cummins, along with other athletes, have petitioned the government for $100 million over 5 years, with the launch of the new Sport Forever campaign. The campaign is aimed at supporting at least 1,000 community sports clubs with rising costs and climate change. Joanne Bowen, CEO of Cricket for Climate, points to the need for greater investment in Australia's community clubs to help mitigate the growing realities of climate impact, support children and families, and ensure the continued running of community-based sports venues. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Ms. Bowen to hear more.
What is Cricket for Climate and what is the aim of the new Sports Forever campaign?
Cricket for Climate is a player-led movement set up by Australian Test captain Pat Cummins back in 2021. Effectively, we're all about trying to protect cricket forever. We know that it is being subject to financial pressures. It's also being pressured through heat and extreme rain. So we're all about really pushing practical solutions across community clubs, including solar and battery and all weather solutions. And yeah, we've been doing that really since the beginning of 2022. And we've had a few conversations with the Australian government, and it's a program and a solution that works. It's saving clubs money, and that money's going back into grassroots sport. And so we decided to lift up a level and launch Sport Forever, which is effectively a way in which we can future-proof not just cricket, but all sports clubs at a community level through solar, through battery, and through all weather solutions. So we're asking the Australian government for $100 million over the next 5 years to future-proof 1,000 community sport clubs across the country.
Would this just be for cricket clubs or all sport clubs?
No, so this is taking the model that we have created across cricket clubs and really saying that AFL clubs, soccer clubs, rugby clubs, surf life-saving clubs, all of these clubs that are the heartbeat of Australian community are crying out for these solutions, and certainly they are very much a target for this funding as well.
How does climate change affect community sports clubs?
I don't think you have to go too far to read about that in the news at the moment. There's been so many closures by councils this year, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland, because of the extreme rain that we've been seeing. So the fields are waterlogged, they're not safe to play on, they get closed by council, which means that kids and adults alike are missing out on actually getting out there and playing the games that they love. That's certainly one of the big impacts. The other, of course, is the heat. So when I talk to club presidents, they're wanting to shift the game back to later on in the day because it's too hot in some parts of Australia to have kids out running around safely. And for that, you need LED lighting, and for that, you need creative energy and solar and battery solutions. So we're seeing the impacts in a number of different ways. And of course, we know that there's 14 million Australians that take part in community sports in some way or other every week. This is really part of our lifestyle. It keeps us fit and healthy and active. And as per our name, we're really all about making sure that there is sport forever by putting these practical solutions in place that also save and in some instances make clubs money to put back into grassroots sport.
On the $100 million in funding, what exact improvements would these clubs see from the investment?
It'll be on a case-by-case basis, but what we have put forward is we know that clubs can absolutely benefit from solar, battery, EV charging solutions that actually start to save them money and can support powering for community members as well. We're looking at water drainage solutions so that we can keep the fields open and safe to play. We're looking at shade and weather monitoring solutions so that we can be confident that players are out there safely. And also part of this as well is using the solutions that we put in place to support conversations with community members. Where we've done this work before, we've seen community members from cricket clubs really start to understand how this can benefit them and taken the next step and put their own solutions on their own homes. And so it really has this potential to support clubs, but also support community members get on board with some of these solutions.
Joanne Bowen, CEO of Cricket for Climate, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio. As coverage over the fatal shooting of two police officers in rural Victoria continues, media have reported the alleged shooter, self-identified as a very active sovereign citizen. A number of experts point to a growing trend in pseudo-law, conspiracy theory, and the sovereign citizen movement, a marginal ideology that rejects Australia's laws and has at times been linked with violence. So, how do active sovereign citizens claim they are immune from Australia's laws? I spoke with Dr. Harry Hobbs, Associate Professor at the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales.
So, pseudo-law adherents in Australia claim not to have to follow the laws of the land in a number of different ways. They may say that some higher law means that laws passed by Parliament or decisions handed down by judges don't apply to them. Often they say things like the Magna Carta means they don't need to do X, Y, or Z, like pay their mortgage or wear a mask or get a vaccine. That's not true, and no court has ever agreed with them, but they make that argument. They may also say that if they don't individually consent to the laws passed by Parliament, those laws don't apply. Again, that's not true, and no court has ever found that it's correct, but they make that argument. Sometimes, and this one's a bit strange, they may say that the law actually applies to a different person called a straw man. So they say that when you're born as an individual sovereign who is free and cannot have any laws imposed upon them, but that government creates a straw person when they issue a birth certificate. So actually, any laws apply to that person written on the birth certificate, which is a straw person or a corporate entity, and not the living, natural, free person who walks around. It is very strange. No court, again, has ever accepted it, but it's another thing they might argue.
So there seems to be quite a lot of, you know, specific language use or beliefs associated with this increasing movement. Is that, that's right?
That's right, yeah. So it's quite a developed legal theory that underlies the arguments that they make. Again, no court anywhere in the world has ever accepted them, but that doesn't mean that they can't argue them.
And can you please provide any insight in regards to prospective overlap with micronations or the concept of micronations?
Yeah, so micronations are where people who purport to secede and create their own country. So again, they might say, look, the Magna Carta allows me to do this, or I don't necessarily agree with the laws of Australia, and so I'm going to create my own community, my own country, and I'm going to call it the Principality of Hutt River, for example, in Western Australia. So in the 1970s onwards in Australia, there was a bit of a micronations boom where a whole bunch of people started doing these things. They didn't necessarily like the drift towards republicanism that people might have seen. They didn't like the way that laws interacted with them or affected them. And so they decided to create their own country. Again, none of this is legal, but there's no law against calling yourself a prince and claiming to be the king of a different country, as long as you continue to pay your taxes and follow the road rules. Now, sovereign citizens and pseudo-law adherents, I think, or the contemporary manifestation of them, are a little bit different. They seem to be less kind of communitarian or orientated, or less sort of state orientated. They're not really that interested in creating their own country. They seem to be more interested in just avoiding the laws of the land themselves and as individuals, I suppose.
And there's been growing concerns around the movement, with some identifying 2020, you know, COVID's primary year, as a significant upturn. What impact is this major increase, or this increase, having on court systems?
Yeah, so as I noted, there have always been people who have strange legal beliefs and, you know, claim the laws don't apply to them. But COVID really saw a huge acceleration in the number of people making these sorts of arguments. And that has flowed through into a whole range of impacts on any state authority that interacts with the regular public. So courts are one. We saw a huge uptick in the number of people appearing in court saying that the laws don't apply to them. And because of the way they behave, which is often very confrontational and assertive and aggressive, it can really impact the administration of justice in lots of strange ways. So if a matter might ordinarily take 20 minutes, it could take 4 hours. They'll appeal everything. Some judges have even told me that they've appealed orders that were actually made in their favour. So they're just very kind of pathologically assertive and confrontational and aggressive, I suppose.
And, you know, very recently we've seen the alleged shooter in an incident that's seen two police officers shot dead in rural Victoria. We've seen that alleged shooter linked with the sovereign citizen movement. What impact is the movement also having on consequence or change in how laws are applied, enforced, and interpreted by courts and other institutions?
So I want to be clear, the movement is having no impact on how laws are interpreted. The movement has never succeeded in having any of its arguments accepted by a court, but certainly in terms of the enforcement of laws, it's more troubling or more difficult, right? So if someone doesn't pay rates, the council need to implement proceedings in court to force that to happen.
Dr. Harry Hobbs, Associate Professor at the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales, speaking with me. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show, also brought to you from Radio Adelaide. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.